The point is, we were out there investigating. This is what we found. You can believe whatever you want. I don't know what it's all about. I'm trying to find out myself, but I'm not going to put it under the carpet and pretend it didn't happen. I believe that many of the cases were legitimate. The witnesses were legitimate. Many of those people had for years problems dealing with some of the events that they were part of. He said he saw these dark figures running around the distance, but as he got closer, there were four or five hairy people with eyes like coals of fire, and he began to shoot randomly at them and ran into the house. And at the same time, over the trees in the woods, there's this large object, he said, like a big crystal thorn with different colored lights hovering over there at the same time. And the question I keep asking myself is, what is going on?
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of banalofamerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 6. Before we dive into this week's installment of the program, once again, I want to give big, big thanks to our good buddy Ian for contributing the theme music for this week's installment of the program. You'll be hearing Ian's song on the program here over the next few weeks and months, but we're also going to try and sprinkle in some other tunes by various other very talented members of the BOA Audio listening audience. So do not fret if you're one of those folks out there who is a musician and wants to contribute to the program. Just shoot me a line at boaaudio@hotmail.com, and we'll be sure to give your stuff a listen. Now that we've taken care of that, let's get down to business on this week's edition of the program, and it is truly a wild installment of BOA Audio as we welcome veteran UFO and paranormal researcher Stan Gordon for an in-depth discussion on his new book, Silent Invasion, which details the UFO Bigfoot wave that swept across Pennsylvania in 1973 and 74. If you have not heard of this story, trust me, my friends, it is mind-blowing stuff. In 1973, there was this wave of UFO sightings in Pennsylvania, and all of a sudden come a whole bunch of Bigfoot sightings. And I'm not talking about one or two. We're talking about dozens and dozens of Bigfoot sightings in the summer of 1973. And as if things could not get any more strange, there were cases where UFOs and Bigfoot were seen in the same place. So truly, truly strange stuff that went on in Pennsylvania in 1973 and 74. And what makes Stan Gordon's work quite remarkable is that Silent Invasion is not just an examination of this 73-74 UFO Bigfoot wave. It is a recounting of the cases because he was on the ground during the wave. He was really the primary investigator of this amazing turn of events. Some of the avenues we'll explore here in the conversation include the bizarre nature of these Bigfoot reports, the media frenzy that surrounded the wave, Stan's work during that time with local authorities and how that got him access to truly fresh and odd cases. We'll also learn about mysterious signs of clandestine government interest in the UFO Bigfoot wave as it unfolded, and Stan will recount some of the most mind-blowing cases that he investigated as this was all going on. In addition to all that, we're going to try and get meta on this, because during the 73-74 wave, Stan Gordon was only 24 or 25 years old at the time. And seeing as it is over 30 years since that big event, we're going to get his perspective on the world of ufology, how it has evolved and changed in the 5 decades that he's been involved in the field. Plus, we'll explore what folks in the UFO community and cryptozoological community have to say about that 73-74 UFO Bigfoot wave. We've spent time here on Season 6 examining the Bigfoot mystery, and as I said with Gian Cassar, I thought I knew one thing about Bigfoot, but his work just had me flummoxed and wondering what this creature was all about, and I have a feeling that many of you are going to feel the same way after you hear this conversation with Stan Gordon. For those of you unfamiliar with Stan Gordon, allow me to provide you with a little background on him. Since 1965, Stan Gordon has been conducting on-scene investigations of mysterious encounters in Pennsylvania. He has been involved with the examination of thousands of UFO and other strange reports from across the Keystone State. During the late 1960s, Stan acted as a telephone report sighting coordinator for the UFO Research Institute of Pittsburgh, and has been internationally recognized as an authority on the subject of the UFO and Bigfoot phenomena. He gained prominence from his first-hand investigation into the well-remembered 1973-74 UFO-Bigfoot series of sightings and encounters, which occurred in Pennsylvania. He founded the Westmoreland County UFO Study Group in 1970, which expanded to the Pennsylvania Center for UFO Research in 1975. In addition to all that, Stan Gordon served as the Pennsylvania State Director for the Mutual UFO Network for many years and was the first recipient in 1978 of the annual MUFON Meritorious Achievement and a UFO Investigation Award. He also continues to investigate information concerning the controversial UFO crash retrieval case, which occurred on December 9, 1965, near Kecksburg in Pennsylvania, and has been the primary investigator of the event for many years. He's the author of Silent Invasion, as noted. That's the book we're going to be discussing here on the program this week, as well as Really Mysterious Pennsylvania. And his website is www.stangordon.info. Pretty simple, all one word, stangordon.info. That's a website that is rich with information and details about Stan Gordon's 50-plus years investigating UFOs and the paranormal. Be sure to check it out. And with all that said, I'm sure you are chomping at the bit to hear this edition of the program, so let's get down to business and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on March 8, 2011. Stan Gordon talking about Silent Invasion, the Pennsylvania UFO Bigfoot Wave of 1973 and 74 on BOA Audio Season 6. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 6. And as we've sort of been exploring the periphery of the paranormal here this season, I'm very excited about where we're going to be journeying to today on the program. Our guest has been a stalwart in the world of ufology for over 50 years, and this is something that I hadn't realized really until I read the book and found out more about his background, and that to me was personally just amazing and stunning, and kudos to him for lasting this long in this crazy field, and he's seen a lot of stuff, so I'm looking forward to talking to him about that. Talking about Stan Gordon, serious player in Pennsylvania UFO research and just paranormal research in Pennsylvania. He's been really walking the back roads and main streets of Pennsylvania trying to track down paranormal mysteries for, as I said, over 50 years. So he's seen a lot of stuff. And he's got a new book out, which is some mind-blowing stuff that I think everybody out there should get their hands on. It is called Silent Invasion, the Pennsylvania UFO Bigfoot Casebook. And it details this just mind-blowing wave of UFO and Bigfoot sightings that were happening in, I guess you could say, southwestern Pennsylvania primarily in 1973 and 1974. And it is just rigorously detailed, covers an amazing array of cases, and we'll find out exactly how many in a few moments. And as I said, it'll blow your mind, folks, because I'd heard about the Bigfoot UFO kind of connection, but never had heard about what happened in Pennsylvania in the early 1970s until I read this book. So kudos to him. Stan Gordon, I've talked long enough here. People want to hear from you. So welcome to BOA Audio. It's a long time coming. We should have had you on much sooner, and hopefully this is the first of many future appearances. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you very much for having me on today.
Now, again, I got to put over this book just thought-provoking stuff because, like I said, nobody really ever wants to touch on the UFO Bigfoot connection, and it sounds like this thing may have, with the exception of your work and maybe some other people sort of side mentioning it, this thing's sort of fallen through the cracks in a big way, the 73-74 wave that happened down there in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, it was an amazing time to live through, and you know, I've had many people who were around at that time and they still talk to me about it, and I was encouraged by a lot of these people to bring this book out, but one of the main reasons I did it was because I felt that this was such an important part of history,
mm-hmm.
both for cryptozoology and for UFOs, and no doubt some of the strangest events in history were recorded during that time and are very well documented because we were on the scene within minutes to hours of many of these cases after they occurred. And I just felt that this was something that really needed to come forward in the hope that other researchers or other witnesses or people who had information on similar events might come forward so we have more information to look at these reports because, as you know, those in the UFO field don't like to connect UFOs with Bigfoot reports. And those who are dealing with Bigfoot, who are, of course, are the idea these things are zoological in nature, which is what my initial information and initial data suggested. And again, I keep an open mind to all aspects of it. But those in the zoological field don't want to connect UFOs with what they're finding. But I think I'm also finding that in more recent years, more and more people in both fields are starting to ask more questions about the phenomenon in general. And I'm hopeful that more people might come forward now with this information coming out.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree with you there. It does seem like there's been sort of a changing of perspective in recent years where, you know, it feels like a lot of these fields have sort of reached the saturation point and they're sort of starting to look in other areas to sort of maybe there's, you know, pieces of the puzzle in this other area that I haven't looked at yet. So this book, again, you know, coming along at the right time for sure. And you point out here, too, that it's of interest and it should be noted to the folks here listening that it's you didn't just chronicle this 1973-74 wave that happened down there, but you were on the scene investigating these cases. So, you know, the book reads like that. It reads like someone who actually went to talk to these witnesses and really got the information from them. You're not just, you know, telling secondhand stories that you heard. You know, you were there, as you said, within minutes or hours after these sightings
right.
had occurred.
That's exactly right. And I should probably give your listeners a little bit of an idea of some of the background and how we got involved in this type of event and how we were set up to do this. And actually, my interest in this began when I was 10 years old. And my birthday was in the Halloween season, so my parents had given me a new AM radio on my 10th birthday. And I was tuning around a radio dial that night because of strange, unusual happenings. They were talking about flying saucers and ghosts and strange creatures. And I was 10, but I was really interested in science. I was very curious. And I was wondering if these people are all crazy or they're making these stories up. Is there something to it? So I began to make frequent trips to our local library, and I began to watch the newspapers, and I cut articles out and make scrapbooks. And if I saw an article in the local paper that somebody had seen something strange, I called them on the phone and talked to them about it personally and began to keep records of it. And so my interest continued. And in 1969, I decided to set up a hotline. And that's several years after the Kexburg incident. I was 16 when the Kexburg incident happened in 1965. So it was that case that led me out in the field to do first-hand investigation. And in 69, I decided to set up a hotline. And I began to make contact with the local police and the news media. I told them what I was doing. And as you know, back then there was quite a bit of ridicule on these subjects, but I tried to handle it very seriously and open-mindedly. And as word got around about my hotline, my phone was just being inundated with calls. And calls were coming in day and night, and it was much more than I could handle on my own. So I decided that I wanted to set up a volunteer group of research people, scientists, engineers, technicians, people who had experience in investigation to respond to these cases and hopefully to get there while the phenomenon was ongoing. And that was my goal. So in 1970, I founded the first group that was called the Westmoreland County UFO Study Group. And we had a number of good volunteers involved in it. We all did this around our regular jobs. With my electronics background, I set up a pretty involved communication center in my home. And I set up and designed a two-way radio system so we could radio dispatch some of the investigators out to the scene of these events. And so by the time that 1973 came around, our group was already very active. We had been investigating a lot of reports. The group was becoming well-known across the state of Pennsylvania. And as this outbreak began, first with UFO sightings, and those who were around will recall that it was in the fall of 1973 that the United States experienced this major wave of UFO activity. But it actually started here January 1st, actually, and continued all year long. And we had hundreds of UFO cases we looked into, and many, of course, were explainable, but there were many significant, very detailed cases, which are mentioned in Silent Invasion.
Mm-hmm.
There was that series of events that began in the summer of 73 with this massive outbreak of Bigfoot activity. That was just an amazing time to live through. And, you know, we could talk in more detail about that, of course, as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, you beat me to the punch on the bio background. I appreciate that, actually, because you saved me from being too standardized here at the beginning of the show. Just to go back to the bio background for you, I think it bears repeating here for folks. You know, you started up this UFO hotline in 1969. You're 20 years old. You started the group the next year. You're 21. This whole thing happens, you know, in 73, 74. And, you know, you're about 24, 25 years old. I mean, kudos to you. All over the years here on this program, we've pushed for more young people to get involved in ufology and the paranormal. And, I mean, you were out there doing it back in the late 60s. And it just amazed me, too. I had to keep sort of keeping that in the front of my mind as I'm reading the book here. I can imagine you sort of this young guy out there talking to these people and really getting to the bottom of these cases.
And it was difficult in some cases because, you know, here's myself talking to, in some cases, police officers, pilots, very responsible older individuals, and here I am, a young guy, talking about some of the strangest things or maybe the strangest event of their life.
Mm-hmm.
But people were glad to have somebody who would listen to them, to share their experience. They knew I was going to keep their names confidential if that's what they requested, which is something that still goes on today. Many people ask not to be identified because of the ridicule factor, even though it's not nearly as bad as it was back in those early days. But anyhow, you know, we got a lot of experience because a lot of the research people we were dealing with in our groups at the time. And it was just an amazing time to live through and to get out there and witness firsthand the emotion of the witnesses, to see the evidence. And I'd say besides the fact of not just the footprints and other evidence we found at the scene in certain cases, but what was so dramatic was the animal reactions. People can be fooled, but animals cannot. And that's something that even some of the police officers told us who investigated some cases, how strange the animals were responding. There's no way that could be fabricated. And that was probably the best evidence that I saw at the time.
Absolutely, yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is the kind of firsthand perspective that you only get really from going on to the scene and picking up these little details that perhaps would get lost on somebody else. So, like I said, the book's invaluable really in that regard, and I highly recommend it to people. I have some notes here sort of as I went through the book looking at all these different cases. You may know, I guess, or I hope you do. How many cases would you say are profiled in the book altogether?
Oh, boy. You know, I can't even tell you. There are many dozens of Bigfoot cases and multitudes of UFO cases. And I know there was other cases we didn't even include in the book because a lot of it was repetitious. And some things were, you know, misidentified. There were some hoaxes, and we mentioned some of those in the book. But I didn't want to take up extra pages with a lot of the things that's just over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. But there's just tons. I mean, just as a point here, we'll eventually get to sort of the August Bigfoot wave. But just to make a point, I actually stopped and counted from just August 15th to the 20th, there were 15 Bigfoot or creature sightings. So, I mean, just take that into account, folks. I mean, that's 15 sightings over the course of 5 days. That's like three a day, you know, and just imagine that happening nowadays. People would be going crazy.
Right, and in some areas, that's exactly what was began to happen because certain areas, we'll be talking a lot about the Chestnut Ridge area. And the Chestnut Ridge is a mountain range that runs from Preston County, West Virginia, through Westmore and Fayette, Indiana County, in southwest Pennsylvania. And that area in western PA along the ridge is a continuous year after year active area for strange events, UFO sightings, Bigfoot activity, a lot of other phenomena that goes on. And why there's so much activity, especially Bigfoot activity, especially outside of Latrobe, around Derry Township along that part of the ridge, even in recent years. And but back at that time, there was a lot of activity going on out there. And some of these cases, you know, as you saw in the book, we could be in one incident, and at the same time, about the same time, at a distance, we had another report. So you knew you were dealing with more than one creature. And in fact, there were some cases where we had multiple creatures involved.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. It's bizarre. It's just really, that's what struck me. It was like, this doesn't seem to make any sense that there was this, like you kind of laid out what happened here as far as this flap as we're going to dig deeper into it. It seems like it started with UFOs, then all of a sudden Bigfoots just started appearing, you know, towards the summer and into the fall. And then, you know, it seemed like there was sort of a cross-section of UFO sightings and Bigfoot sightings, most of the time not together, but then you know, you're seeing Bigfoot and UFO at the same time. So,
yeah.
You know, and then it seems like the wave kind of petered out slowly over 74, and then the wave sort of dissipated, if you will. Obviously, these sort of sightings still happen from time to time, but the explosion of what went on that year or that 2 years hasn't really been repeated, right?
Right. Well, there was nothing like that ever, as far as I know, before or since that episode.
Mm-hmm.
But as the reports dwindled, of course, in 74, the sighting has continued. And as far as I can recall, as of right now, there have been Bigfoot sightings reported in Pennsylvania every year since that time, but nothing in the numbers like we saw during that outbreak.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so that's sort of like the wave to bring people up to speed, and then we're going to dig into some of these various incidents that happened and sort of the story of what was going on during all this time, because there's a lot of sort of threads that you can see and discern as you read through the cases and the chronology of it, which I found really sort of interesting. It just kind of plays a little bit like a movie, or it plays sort of like, you know, I imagine, you know, I'm just getting these dispatches from the field from you as I'm reading the book, and it's like, what is this? This is getting crazier and crazier.
Yeah, and I tried to do it from a personal perspective of what I was doing, what I was seeing, what I was feeling, what I was experiencing at the time, and I was trying to get that across to the reader because, again, it was such an amazing time to live through. And as I said many times in the past, if I had not been involved in this, nobody could ever convince me it was real. It was like living a real science fiction movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It definitely feels that way as you're going along in the book. Now, I did notice one thing that stood out for me here, because this was something I had never really heard before with UFO sightings. I'm sort of just getting into somewhat specific notes. I hope they're not too specific. One of them here was that there were two sightings in mid-March of 73 where the witnesses saw UFO and reported a strange smell associated with it, which was something that I'd never really heard before. Is this something that you've come across?
It's not that common, but an occasion. There have been some reports of odors, sometimes more acidy, but sometimes, again, something like the rotten egg sulfur-like smell.
Okay, so similar to the Bigfoot smell.
That's very, very rarely reported.
Interesting, but sometimes with the UFOs, but rarely.
Very rarely, yeah.
There's something about that smell, yeah, because as I was reading the book and I hear these guys reporting that, I'm like, oh, here come the Bigfoot. Sort of makes you wonder what if there's some correlation there that we haven't figured out yet.
Again, as I stress in the book, you know, in many of the Bigfoot reports, you do have that very strong, uncomfortable odor that people have described. Some people actually said they felt sick afterwards, smelling the strong odor, which many described as like rotten egg, sulfur, rotten meat, something been dead for a long period of time. But it's not reported in all of the cases.
That's the strange thing about the whole thing, and you kind of bring it into perspective too with the UFOs, because it's like, no, I'm sure there's a lot of sort of like standardized versions of UFO sightings, but no UFO sighting itself seems to be the same as any other one. And it's kind of that case too with these Bigfoot sightings. As you're reading the book, it's like this one's just a little bit different from the last one, and this time the Bigfoot did something a little bit different that, you know, you haven't seen in any of the cases. It's very, you know, I really like that a lot, because there was so many details in the book that really stood out like that.
Well, we did try to make it very detailed as we could. And as I said, there is many unanswered questions. I don't have the answers of what took place. I'm relating what we found.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that many of the cases were legitimate. The witnesses were legitimate. Many of those people had for years problems dealing with some of the events that they were part of. A lot of people couldn't accept what they actually saw because, you know, the high percentage of witnesses, even today, not just from 73, 74, but so many of the really detailed UFO Bigfoot observers are people who had never would have believed unless they had their own experience. And many of these are people who used to laugh about it.
That seems to always be the case. It's the guys like me who are into the subject never get to see anything. That's like
Well, I don't know if you caught it in the book, but you know, it'll be 52 years I've been doing this now, coming up in October. And in all the years I've been doing this, I have never personally seen a UFO or a Bigfoot. I've seen a lot of evidence. I've interviewed thousands of people. I'm convinced from the pattern of the evidence we've seen that something's going on, but I never had my own personal experience.
That's always seems to be the case. It's strange like that. Now, what I noticed, too, as a recurring theme here in the book with regards to these Bigfoot sightings, as far as evidence goes, the tracks were seen predominantly three-toed, which is, I feel, at least, is fairly unique to the Bigfoot. You know, how prevalent are these three-toed tracks in the annals of Bigfootery, if you will?
Okay, well, actually, during the 70s, there were many reports around the country of three-toed footprints, and in fact, in many parts of the country where you have the typical five-toed tracks, like in the Pacific Northwest, there are reports of three-toed, even four-toed tracks showing up, which adds to the mystery. But while it was very common to have a lot of these three-toed tracks showing up, There were also reports of five toe tracks, even in the 70s.
Yeah.
And we still get reports of mainly we get more – in the last few years, we've had more, I'd say, of five-toed footprints showing up. But there's a lot of mystery and phenomena to what we were finding and what we're still finding today, and many questions that I have myself about the Bigfoot phenomena. And I'm sure we'll be talking about some of this as we get further into the book and more about the phenomena itself. But just for example, just several weeks ago, in the snow, out in this area, they found a long series of very unusual footprints, large, bipedal, but completely different than your normal Bigfoot tracks. But there was no indication they were fabricated. So there's just a lot of things that show up that, you know, we just don't have the answers for.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And as you get deeper into the book, as we'll probably get, as I'm sure we're going to get into, the easy answer of this is just some mysterious cryptid animal that we haven't found yet, you know, that gets very murky as these incidents start to pile up.
Well, they did for me because, you know, I started out in the field in the late 60s, and when I was in high school, graduated, what was it, 67, and I remember some of the kids out there would be coming to me and tell me their stories, and their family members would tell me stories because they knew of my interest already. And I remember some of the kids tell me how they used to go parking with their dates out in this one particular area, which now has a long history of Bigfoot encounters. But back then, the kids would talk about going out to this very rural area, parking with their dates, and having what they said was a gorilla coming out of the woods and throwing rocks at their car. And that's an area now that's had a lot of Bigfoot activity for many, many years. And so, you know, as from the early days, I started hearing these stories of alleged Bigfoot cases. And one of the earliest reports I had was down along what they call Lober, down towards West Newton, along the creeks down there, where apparently a number of people had encountered a large, white, hairy creature. And the white ones are not that common, but as you see in the book, we do have some reports of those as well. But as I got into these early reports, I mean, my opinion was that we're dealing with some type of unknown primate, some type of unknown zoological specimen. And that's how, for years and years, you know, we went into the field looking for evidence and thinking that's where it was going to lead us until, as you see what happened, as some very strange events began to unfold during that wave of 1973.
Yeah, I mean, I found myself completely flummoxed by the end of the book with regards to just what this Bigfoot creature is, because you touched on something that I had completely forgotten about, and that was just that the descriptions of this thing ran the gamut of sort of the shades of the hair, too. So, if this is an unknown species, we're talking about quite a few different creatures out there, white ones, tan ones, gray ones, brown ones. It's like this is a lot, something's going on.
And your different footprints. And, yeah. You know, something I bring up, and I was just talking to another researcher a little bit ago about this, and, you know, when you go to some of the conferences I speak at, I bring some of the castings I had from over the years from Pennsylvania, of different castings from different events. And while some of them have very great similarity, some of them are extremely different. And yet there's no indication of those cases of them being fabricated. I mean, the witnesses appear to be legitimate. They had no reason to make up the story. They weren't looking for any publicity. The evidence was pretty clean at the scene. Here you've got a whole series of footprints that are completely different than some of the what we call the normal Bigfoot tracks, even the three-toed or the five-toed tracks. So the question I keep asking myself is, what is going on? If these are legitimate tracks, what is going on? How, you know, it's difficult enough to believe we're dealing with one type of unknown specimen, but the fact that there could be multiple types of things out there, it just doesn't seem likely unless there's something we just don't understand that could be part of this phenomena.
Yeah, exactly. There's something missing here we haven't quite figured out yet. We haven't quite, you know, stumbled upon yet. Maybe we won't even be able to. Who knows? But it's as I said, it's completely mind-boggling. Now, during this whole wave, let's sort of set the mood a little bit, too, as far as, like, what people might have been going through. What was there quite a – it seemed like there was quite a media blitz, if you will, or quite – you know, it sounded like they were really on top of this with regards to how prevalent these UFO and Bigfoot sightings were.
It was getting as reports were unfolding and the reports were circulating around the area and people were getting more and more concerned, the media in general, in this area, especially in the areas like around Latrobe, where you had the Latrobe Bulletin, some of the other small town papers that were around at the time are no longer in existence today, they were covering this story very, very well. And it was front page for days of some of them. And this went on for weeks. And it got to the point where it got bigger and bigger. The bigger papers started to pick it up. It started to make national news. It hit the national news wire. And we, our group was just being inundated. I mean, I was luckily in a position. I was managing a small little electronics firm here in town at the time. And I was able to take some vacation time off. And I spent just several weeks just working on this full time around the clock. And if you can visualize it, if you go to my website, stangordon.info, you can see a part of some of my communication center, my radio room. Well, if you can visualize back in those days, that's a little more modern today, but we had a, I had a lot of equipment here. And we had two phone lines here. The communication center was set up in my home. During this wave, it was being manned 24 hours a day with our people from our research group, the phones and the radios, and we had teams out there day and night responding to these events. I mean, it was unbelievable. I mean, I remember in 1 week the phone lines went out of order twice, and the phone companies said they'd never seen like it before. There were so many calls coming in. The phone lines back then couldn't handle all the calls coming in at the time. And, again, we'd be responding to these events 24 hours a day. And it was just an amazing time to live through.
It sounds just insane. And the point, too, that you touched on this earlier, and you can read it, you know, throughout the book, is that, you know, you worked really closely with the local and state police during this whole thing. I mean, you were almost sort of like their rapid response X-Files team of sorts. It sounded like at one point you point out that you would get a call like from the 911 dispatcher that you had to call 911 to find out, you know, that there was a pretty hot case going on right now that you should go and check out. So
actually what they were doing for a period of time when this outbreak was really at its peak, they were doing a special code signal over the fire and civil defense dispatch radio system to me, which I had a radio monitor in my car. And that would notify me to call in right away that something had occurred.
Yeah, code red,
and,
right?
Yeah, and there were times when we would be out on the scene and we'd hook up with either the local police or the state police at some of the investigations. And sometimes they responded to certain events. But quite often they were referring the calls to the callers to contact us to investigate, or they would refer the report over that they had received a report on this and we would follow up on it.
Right, right. And it sort of flies in the face of the general idea that maybe that you were out there sort of on your own doing this, or that you were, you know, dissuaded by the police not to get involved, or, you know, they really embraced you and your work and your team there to really sort of get to the bottom of this and take some of the load off of them, it seems.
Well, you know, by the time that this happened, we had started the group in 1970. By 73, the group had taken on a level of, responsibility. And they realized that we were out there trying to scientifically work on cases just in general. And we weren't out there to try to prove anything. We weren't out to try to prove that UFOs or extraterrestrial or Bigfoot was whatever it was. We were out there gathering evidence to try to determine what these things were. And as we found then, as we find today, and I may have mentioned this earlier, you know, when you properly investigate these reports, many phenomena appear to be strange and unusual initially, but when you investigate them, the high percentage are determined to be either natural or man-made in origin. There were Bigfoot misidentifications. I mean, cases of, you know, big dogs, a bear, you know, different things along that line. Lots of things were misidentifications for UFO sightings, and they still are today. But there was many really well-documented cases at the time you could not easily dismiss. And I think the fact was that our group was there. We were pretty much trained to handle these reports. We were out there investigating the reports, and the police department just didn't have time to follow up on everything.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it's also unique in a way, I think, and something I wish we kind of had more of nowadays. Sort of these localized groups that were really, seen as responsible by the police and the authorities like that. You know what I mean? It seems like nowadays they may get more dismissed by the authorities. So I wish we had more groups like that nowadays. But, you know, times have changed.
Oh, yes. that they have.
Before I get into some of the other stuff, let's talk a little bit more about sort of when the Bigfoot wave exploded. What were you thinking, like, when this went on? Because it sounded like you guys, I mean, the name of your group was the WCUFOSG. So
right.
Were you guys, like, taken aback that all of a sudden you were in the Bigfoot business?
Well, of course, it was a Westmoreland County UFO study group. And while we were dealing mainly with UFO reports, we would get calls on various types of other phenomena as well. And but we were mainly dealing with our local county, even though we would get reports into the Pittsburgh area, which is like 30 miles away, and other areas around there. And but as this wave really began to expand across the strait in 73, the group was getting well known across the state. And in fact, in 1975, because we were dealing mainly statewide, we changed the name of the group to the Pennsylvania Center for UFO Research. And then I founded another group in 1981, which served as a statewide clearinghouse phenomena. That was the Pennsylvania Association for the Study of the Unexplained. But since 1993, I've been working on my own as an independent researcher.
But I guess just to throw back to that, so to take people, I guess, into the moment, what were you thinking when all of a sudden, like, these Bigfoot sightings just started piling up? I mean, I'm sure before that you'd heard the stories, but now it's like, I mean, you had to have seen, you know, that all, something very strange is going on right now. Like, what were you thinking when all that went down?
Well, you know, again, prior to that, we had been aware of a history of Bigfoot case in Pennsylvania, the reports, you know, from the Native Americans and even newspaper accounts going back to the 1800s. But and I heard in the 60s of reported some sightings around the area. Actually, 72, and I go over some of those cases in the book as well, there were some interesting events involving UFO cases. And then a short outbreak of incidents involving cases, for example, people reporting what they said was a gorilla walking across a highway near Latrobe. And there was one other event where people reporting strange lights around the cemetery and a wooded area. Then people reporting this big hairy Hulk type thing chasing dogs, and those were interesting the year before. But how this all began in 73, of course, there was all the UFO activities going on, but it was actually on August the 7th that I got a call from a relative of a person who had an experience which actually occurred on July 31st in a rural area outside of Greensburg. I was out behind the old Green Gate Mall area. Back then, there was a lot of woods around there. But today things have grown up quite a bit. But how the story unfolded was that night of July 31st, this fella was shaving. He got up early for work, and he was shaving as he normally did. And it was a warm night. And he's in the bathroom, and he starts to smell this funny odor that he said looks like rotten cucumber. And he turns around, and he looks at the window. And here in the window, in the bathroom window, here's these two huge glowing orange eyes. But the window's 8 feet off the ground. And he runs into the other room and calls some of the other relatives, and they run in. Of course, whatever was there was gone, but they could smell the odor. They had dogs outside, but the dogs weren't barking, which is odd because they generally bark at anybody who's around. And apparently this guy had some medical problems and taken by ambulance to the hospital the next day and was back from the hospital when I got the call. I went out there that day, that Sunday, August 7th, to talk to the witness and some of the other people. And while I'm there, I learned that a number of boys, local boys, had a number of weeks before had taken a shortcut over to the mall. And again, a lot of brush and woods around there at the time. And they heard this commotion. They thought it was a deer. So they got some rocks, started throwing some rocks, and scared the deer out. And instead of a deer, here comes this large, hairy, tall creature with long arms taking a long gait across the road and up behind the hill, up behind the home. So I was able to interview some of those boys that day. While we were all there, I asked the people on the property, I said, you mind if I go up and look around? They said, sure, you can go up. And some of the boys said, can we go with you? And I said, sure, come on. So we're up there walking around up on the hill up there and looked around for quite a while, didn't see anything. The ground conditions weren't very good. And I'm just about to leave when I happen to look down, and there in front of me is the strangest footprint I'd ever seen. And all the boys were like, wow, like, what is that? What made that? And it was very deep, very clearly defined. As you can see the picture in the book, mm-hmm. It was a three-toed footprint, 13 inches long and 8 inches wide. And I got on the radio, and I called for one of my assistants, and they came out, and we took photographs, measurements, and then made a plaster Paris casting of the track. And while we're out there, we get a radio call that one of our investigators up Oklahoma City, Ohio line that morning had information concerning a creature sighting of a tall, hairy creature looking in a window, and the police have found some strange footprints up there. So that was the beginning of this major wave of events that would begin to extend for weeks and months throughout a large part of southwestern Pennsylvania, but also some other areas down east and other parts of the state as well.
Yeah, I'm recalling that part of the book now and how that did seem to kick off the big wave there. And as I pointed out earlier to folks here, like 15 sightings from August 15th to the 20th. So, I mean, this was a serious wave. I think at the end of the book you say that I think you recorded 118 creature sightings over the course of 73 and the first 2 months of 74. So, you know, 14 months you had 118 sightings. I mean, that's just stunning to me. There had to be something going on beyond what we can even fathom right now. You know, we're gonna get into the speculative realm at that point.
Yeah, in fact, it was just a coincidence that a couple of days ago, a fellow had emailed me and gave me a particular date that he was a child, but he apparently wrote the date down and wanted to know if I knew anything about a UFO sighting that occurred during 73, and coincidentally, it's in my book.
Nice.
Yeah.
So they're still turning up.
Oh, yeah. There's all the time you get reports from people, not just current reports, but people from 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago who saw things. And quite often, because of the filing system I have and the thousands of cases that I've recorded over the years, that I can look things up sometimes for them, and they're so surprised the fact that other people also verified they're having the same sighting about the same time and date.
Now, to sort of keep the story alive, if you will, things to then start getting really weird. And some of the even weirder stuff sort of stood out to me. And one thing that I wanted to talk about is that this recurring sort of you can kind of vaguely see the shadowy hand of the government looking at this whole thing over the course of the book through various incidents. And, you know, they happen here and there, and as you put them all together, you start to get a picture of, like, something that's going on here. There's mail being intercepted, mysterious investigators either impersonating your group or just going there and going to talk to witnesses and pretending they're investigators. You got a call from someone in the government with questions about the whole thing, and then this mysterious bullhorn voice. So a lot of weird stuff going on beyond just the sightings that suggests that there was interest from higher-ups, if you will.
Again, a lot of very strange things. And again, while we dealt mainly with Bigfoot cases and UFO events, then you had a lot of these things that you just brought up. And then you even had some other, even stranger creatures being reported from certain areas and other strange entities being reported. So there was a lot going on, but most of it was focusing on the Bigfoot and UFO activity. But as I mentioned in the book, other strange things are also taking place. And, as it began to unfold, and again, you know, I'm getting into this investigation open-mindedly. Initially, the reports coming in were suggesting more and more that we're dealing with some type of unknown primate,
mm-hmm.
until some other calls begin to come forth from various, and again, these weren't people who were into UFOs or Bigfoot. Most of these calls came in from the general public, sometimes first to the police or the media and then to us, people who were not looking for any publicity but quite often were very, very scared, and they just wanted to have some answers and want to know what was going on. And some of those cases began to present information that began to make us wonder, what exactly are we dealing with here? Some of the things I mentioned, for example, was we'd be out in the field investigating and we'd find a series of footprints that would just suddenly stop and vanish.
Yeah.
When the ground conditions were conducive for more footprints, and where did they go? Or they would just start out of nowhere and continue on and just vanish. There was one particular case, one of the best cases I recall. And this guy, his name was Chester. Chester is now deceased. And Chester was a great guy. I was a retired coal miner. And we became quite good friends after this happened. Chester was a very big Bigfoot skeptic. And he and his wife, and some neighbors were on the porch the night before his encounter, sitting there yelling out loud and making fun of Bigfoot, because it had been in the newspapers, they were joking about it, and he said, come on, Bigfoot, come on out, I want to see you. Well, little did he know that a few hours later he would. And that's one of the stories mentioned in the book. It happened outside of Lake Trove in a little town called Whitney, Pennsylvania. Chester lived in a trailer out there in a mobile home, and early morning hours, he heard this big bang against the trailer, woke him up. And he figured, well, he had a little separate garage out there with a nice antique car, and he figured somebody was breaking in for the car.
Yeah.
They kept the lights out, and they looked out the window to see this huge creature towering over, right, only a few feet away, right next to the trailer, towering over the top of it. And he got a really good look at it, and he woke his wife, and she went over and looked, and she was very, very upset. And poor fellow, he had emphysema from being a coal miner. He could barely talk. didn't want to turn the light on, afraid it might scare it and cause it to do whatever. And he banged it to the wall on the way over, which may have what scared it away. But he got on the phone and called the operator for an emergency to call the state police. And he got a hold of them, and he could barely talk to them. And it wasn't long after that, I believe it was 3 troop cars and 6 troopers went to the scene. And one of the officers called me from the scene that morning. It was early morning, around 4:30 in the morning. And we got out there as soon as we could make it available with the witnesses. But Chester, again, got a very, very detailed account. He had just cut the grass like a short time before that evening, and there was this very large trail of footprints going across the grass. But at one point, they suddenly stopped. And Chester said to me, what is this thing? Can it fly?
It's stunning to me, the breadth and depth of these stories. Now, did you, in retrospect, did you ever find out anything more really about what the government was trying to do or what they were interested in during this whole thing? I mean, were they just as mystified by what was going on as you and I are today, you think? Or did they, you know, have some other reasoning to be investigating all this?
Well, you know, I did mention that there were some representatives of one of the congressmen's office paid us a visit because of all the calls they were having from the public. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to see what was going on. And they were very interested and very open-minded. We kept in touch over a period of time. I didn't see any indication that I was aware of anybody was following up on it. But again, there was that other call that I had mentioned in the book of a person who claimed that they were working for the government, and they were very interested in our investigation, and I was provided the name of a contact at a laboratory in Washington, D.C., in the event that I would come up with any really good physical evidence, but unfortunately not enough to really do that, and of course we never had any contact with them.
Yeah, you make the point in the book. It's like, hey, if I came up with the really good physical evidence to send to you, then the story would be over.
Yeah.
I'd have the Bigfoot.
Yeah.
What could cause that? Clearly aliens can cause that, as happened in Roswell, New Mexico, as happens in a television show I like called The Event. You have to face facts that aliens are all around us, and they have finally gotten to the NHL.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Creepy. That's what this is. You pointed out that I spent a lot of time in Dallas, 20 years, working just a few blocks away from the grassy knoll, the book depository.
So you're a conspiracist.
And the conspiracy museum, which,
right,
oddly enough, has been closed down now. Conspiracy? Could be. Something odd is going on here.
Clearly, it's aliens and Roswellians.